This week on the podcast, I've got something illuminating for you. An encore with Eric Perret and Kim Henry. They're not just photographers. They paint with light, blending art and landscapes in some incredible ways. We dive into their process, from studio to the great outdoors. If you're curious about light painting or just love stunning photography, you'll find this discussion
enlightening.
This is TWIP.
Hey, welcome back to the podcast. I'm your host, Frederick Van Johnson. Today on the podcast, I have some illuminating discussions for you. I get to sit down with two people that you probably already know about. If you have any interest in the topic or the subject line or the title of this video, light painting. Right. What is light painting? It's been around for years, forever, since the beginning of photography. But some people are taking it literally to the next level and beyond. Eric and Kim are two such people. They've built a career around painting with light, showing people how to paint with light and educating and all the things. He creates some fantastic art. They're getting into Web3 and NFTs, all the things that you want to be doing, they're already doing. I have the honor of having them both on the podcast today to talk about the stuff that they're working on. Eric and Kim, welcome to the show. How's it going?
Hi, Frederick. Thanks for having us.
No. We're super happy.
Yeah, it's an honor. I'm a fan and a subscriber and, looking from afar at the just magic that you guys create. I'll tell you, one of the more inspiring things about the work that you create beyond the beauty of the pieces is the way that you guys work together, right? You guys are like a great team. It comes through on camera and all the work that you do. Not everybody has that. You know, the ability to work with their partner and create amazing work together and travel the world and do all this stuff. So bravo for that bit alone there. So let's talk, let's dive into the conversation. I want to first start with sort of introductions to who you guys are. For the folks that may not be familiar with Eric and Kim and or light painting, who is the dynamic duo and how'd you guys get into the space of, creating art with light?
He always does that. Always put me on the spot.
Good. All right. You're on the spot, Kim.
Here it is. You have the dynamic.
But do we like light painting, actually? Because I was listening to your introduction. It sounds super good, but do I even care about light painting? Do you care about light painting?
Yeah, we do.
We're going to demystify all of that today. So what's the story, Kim?
So what can I say? Well, do you want to start from your perspective before? Because Eric has been doing light painting before I got into the development of this technique and this artistic process that we have together. So do you want to start about?
Well, I ditched my soft boxes a long time ago, my strobes, all of that. I was a studio photographer, okay? Mm. I learned, we're in a photography podcast, okay? So I assume that your listeners know about the studio tools.
Yeah.
And I still have all of that, but I don't use those anymore because I found another way that was more interesting for me. So instead of placing a softbox on the light stand and then being behind your camera, why not being the softbox and lighting the subject by hand, okay? And that was one of the first tools that I used probably 10 years ago. Okay, so it's a sheet of paper. Actually, it's a bill from this Montreal city. So if I wrap my sheet of paper around the flashlight and I turn it on like this, okay, then I get some kind of a small softbox. Okay, let me just take it a bit better, like this. All right. So it's so obvious, okay? Just look at the quality of the light on her face.
Yeah.
So it's not about light painting itself. It's about using kind of studio tools, like replicating the studio tools, but by hand. So you're not behind the camera. You're with the subject, and it's way more fun.
And aren't you stretching that out over time, though, right? So, you know, you use the example of a softbox. Softboxes are great, although my last interview with Jake Hicks, he was talking about how he hates softboxes because he's, you know, the color gel guy. But, you know, with softboxes, the short duration of the strobe lets you pose, take the shot, and go on to the next shot. With light painting or with the flashlight, Kim or your subject has to stay still while you do the work, right? So yeah. Is that limiting or freeing?
Both. it's bringing a couple of constraints, of course. So she cannot jump during the shot, okay, that's for sure, because it's not a flash, okay? I'm not going to freeze the action. But there's something more satisfying, at least for me, for the way I work. So when I started to do light painting, it was about 10 years ago, and there were not a lot of ways, not a lot of artists doing that with portraits. And most of the things I was seeing was long exposures of about 1 minute, which was cool, but it was either a bit soft, because 1 minute is a long time to stay still, or it was by using strobe, like mixing strobes and light painting. And I was not a big fan of this for what I was trying to do. I was trying to get everything in one shot, like the trace of the light, the quality of the light on the subject itself. Okay, so it's the way I achieved that after a couple of months of trial and errors is by doing a 1 second exposure. So it goes pretty much like this. Okay, 1 second and we're done.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I'm drawing the light around my subject, and it's pretty simple in the end.
Right. Yeah. The simple technique, but the result, I mean, you know, you're oversimplifying it, right? Because there's a lot, there's a lot more to it. I mean, how do you get the perfect arc, right? You know, like the photo that you have on the screen right now in the lower corner, like, how do you get that perfect arc there? You know, what's the trick for that? Is it something simple or is it experience? You know, there's a lot more to it than just moving the light for a second, right?
Yeah. We like to, I like to see it like as a performance creative process for both of us, actually, because I need to stay still, and I'm my background is in dance, so I'm a performer. But as Eric is also in front of the camera and almost like dancing with the light, depending on the shape that he does. So there's a performative aspect to it. And as far as the shape itself, like the shape of the light is concerned, I think it's like body memory. I really see it like dance, you know, like you practice a movement and then it becomes kind of second nature. Your body knows where your light is in relationship to your subject and to your own body. So it becomes like dance or sport. The body kind of records has a memory of the movement.
It's a dance between the both of you, though, right? Because Kim, you're doing the fluid, you know, poses that come from your dance background, and then Eric has to kind of do the fluid dance around you with the light at the same time. I want to see that. That is art in and of itself. The performance of the image that you're creating is another layer of the art, right?
Yeah, so this is a picture of us on the field. So I'm simply behind Kim with my light, and so as you can see, I'm just drawing a circle, and you said that I'm oversimplifying, but in the case of a circle, it's so easy. And that's why the technique got so popular also. Like, there are tens of thousands of people doing it now.
Yeah.
And the circle is the easiest way to actually achieve it using a long light painting tube.
I'm sorry, Kim, go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was gonna say, what are the basics for it in terms of exposure, right? I'm assuming this is a beach, but you're somewhere, it's night, it's dark, you got your camera, it's on a tripod. Is there a set exposure that you use all the time, or does it vary depending on conditions?
Yeah, so what are the perfect settings for a shot like this, Kim? Mm-hmm.
The perfect settings are the one you need to use. Never the same. It's never the same.
Yeah, never the same. But if you know about landscape photography, you know about mm-hmm. how to expose for this. So yep. the technique is simple. You expose for the background. Okay, so let's say, because it's going to change a lot depending on the time of the night you're shooting. So during the blue hour, it changes every minute. Okay, so yeah, you have to keep adjusting the settings. But basically, it's 1 second, and then you adjust your ISO and f-stop depending on the ambient light. And mm-hmm. then you have to counterbalance with the brightness of the tube. So I have a chart about how to mix these things, because at first it's a bit tricky, but the best way to start is to work just at night without the blue hour, where if you just work with the stars, it's always the same setting. It's going to be 8 seconds, ISO 3200, and f2.8. That's it. You just keep the same settings, and you can play with the stars until you fade out
and you run out of battery, right? So, no, that's interesting. I know a lot of photographers watching this are like, what's the formula? There's got to be a secret formula, or at least a starting point. And I want to get into that, because I know, you know, I'm saying that tongue in cheek, but that's a good starting place. 8 seconds, 3200 ISO at f8, and then, you know, kind of play around from there. But then there's also the gear you use. Like, you started with that flashlight and piece of paper. Clearly, this shot that you have on screen now is not that, right? So you've evolved. Yeah. Cameras have evolved in their, you know, their low noise and low light capability and all the things. So where are we now? Look at this. This is crazy. This is awesome.
So yeah, this is typical of our work, and this is even simpler than a circle. It's just a door, so you go from top to bottom. So what is the tool to do this? It's just a plastic tube. Okay, so this is a 3.5 feet tube, and I simply put a flashlight inside of it. Okay, so just like this, and then I can turn on the light, and it looks like this. Okay, so I simply went behind Kim with that tube, and I did that door.
Lightsaber.
Looks so simple, right?
yeah, that looks deceptively simple, but then. So then here's where the nuances come in. And I know people are thinking, okay, that's great, but okay, you're the photographer, you're setting all this up. Kim, you're the subject. Is there a third person there triggering it? Are you using a self timer? Is it just because it's so dark and you're moving with black clothes on, you're not registering? How does that piece work?
Yeah, so it's just Kim and I. We love to travel together and go to remote places. And I don't know, it's just the way we've been working forever. And we have many friends go out in the fields. There are a bunch of people, like there are 10, and they help each other. And that's super cool too. But we've been working since 2015. It's just the two of us. So I have this remote trigger in my left hand, and the light in my right hand, so there's no trigger on the camera itself. So I'm going to press the shutter with this, and then it starts the exposure, which is going to last between 1 and 8 seconds. I do my movement, and that's it. We get the shot.
Now, are you running back to the camera to check it after every shot, or do you do a bunch of shots and then go back and check and adjust?
Most of the time, we are actually in locations where it's kind of complex to mm-hmm. go like to the camera. So usually, the way we work is we'll do like a series, like maybe up to 10 shots, maybe depending on the workflow. And then Eric will go back to the camera. And most of the time, if we're shooting during the blue hour, you will have to adjust the settings, because to keep the same exposure time, like you will need to adjust a few things in order to have like the background visible, well exposed. And then according to what he sees, he will also adjust the tool, either like the power of the flashlight or even the color, because the sky is changing really fast. So these are very, I like to like put the emphasis on the fact that these are simple concepts. These are, there's something simple about the technique itself, but then when you get into like all the nitty gritty details, this is where it gets juicy and complex. And for us, stimulating, actually.
Yeah, that's what we're talking about every night before going to bed. These small details, how can we improve the small things? And she has those crazy ideas all the time. Can we try this? And then we just talk for hours about where we can bring this. And just to continue on the me getting back and forth. So on that picture, Kim is on a rock and there's water all around her. So I have to step on the same rock to do the light painting, and then to review the images, I have to go in the water, and it's a big loop, okay, to see the images. So that's why I'm going to do at least 10 images when I know that the framing is right. But then I have to go back behind the camera just to have a look of how it looks like. And I remember, like, on that specific shot, it was kind of tricky just to move to go to the camera. But sometimes also we work in sand dunes, and you see where I'm going with this. Where are my footprints? It's like I'm not going to waste time in Photoshop to remove my footprints. too lazy for this. So I run back and forth, and that's keeping me in shape. Light painting is a good way to stay healthy, everyone.
That's amazing. I was going to ask you that because I remember, and correct me if I'm wrong, I remember seeing a video that you guys produced where you were far, right? I mean, this seems pretty far here, but you were really far away, and you were I think you were triggering it remotely. But is there, I guess the basis of the question is there a particular focal length that you are more attracted to, or is it based on the location that you're at and what you both are feeling for the final shot?
Yeah, I guess that what you saw was a stunt. We were trying to see if it could work with a 400 millimeter lenses. We even tried at 800, and not a big success. It's just fun to try, but my favorite focal length would be probably 24. I'm always out in the field with two or three cameras. These days it's more three. So I have 14, 24, and 35. So this way I take the shot with two different focal lengths. So I have kind of a different framing, or sometimes one horizontal, one vertical. And the third camera is filming. And I'm going to switch all of them. So I have video footage from all focal lengths. It's a bit tricky, but this is how I love to work with multiple camera setup.
That's great. There's so much here. So you guys have educational resources up there, right? That are available for people to grab. What can I get? Like, what if I'm a photographer and I'm like, okay, like here's a perfect example. I'm flying to Hawaii later this week for the holiday and for my birthday. I'm bringing my Nikon, you know, Z6II and the 24-70 lens and a tripod. I want to try some of this on the beach. What do I need to do? Like, what is somebody that has never done this and they want to get started? What do they need to do? They get your educational resources? Do I just go get a good flashlight from Target? Like, what do I do?
Okay, so we have about 200 videos about that topic, but that's way too much. Where do you start with this? So we have one page that's guiding you, like the best tutorials that we made when you're getting started. And in your case, to answer your specific question, you would need just one plastic tube, one flashlight, a tripod, of course, okay? Mm-hmm. Because you don't want to put your camera on the rock. It's going to be hard to do the framing.
On the beach. And
that's about it. So then when you become a bit more interested about going deep in the technique, then you see that you need a more fancy flashlight, that you can pop on and off using a pressure switch, because this is how you can draw different strokes of light during the same exposure. And that kind of pressure switch is not made for us light painters, okay? There's nothing made for us. This goes on your gun when you're hunting, okay?
Yeah.
And we're using it for art, but it's not the main purpose. But when you have this, it's more fancy way of doing the light, okay? Mm-hmm. So you can do your light painting within the exposure of your camera. I used to do the opposite. I used to keep my light on during the whole exposure. So once you're in exposure, one circle inside of it. But as I got more into it, now I'm always doing the light painting within the exposure. So my light painting could be like half a second during a 1 second exposure.
So it gives him also like more control on the actual trace of light the traces of light that are possible, because if you have if you need to do the light painting during the whole exposure time of the picture, it means that you have less options. You cannot do, for instance, a shape. Do you have something maybe with a double? Anyway, that being said, it gives more artistic freedom in the way we draw the light. That's for sure.
That's gorgeous. These are all just stunning and gorgeous. So which begs the question, we go back to that one. We have to talk about that before we get in the bullet time shot. So folks that are listening to this on the podcast, if you're familiar with The Matrix and that one bullet time shot that they did of Neo dodging bullets and all that stuff, they recreated that. Eric, or both of you, can you talk about that? Like, what was the driving force behind that? Was it a client, or was it you guys were just sitting around one day saying, hey, we should try this and then do it? What was the driving force?
But actually, just to finish on that point, because I think this is the best example we have with the pressure switch. So you see, we have four traces. We have four traces of light on this shot. Okay, so this is how I achieve that, is by pressing the button four times while being in motion around him. And to answer your question, it's gonna take a half an hour.
Actually, where everything started, within a 360 degree environment. So.
I learned.
Sorry, Eric, you never should have brought that photo up. So now I can't let it go.
No, it's all good. It's all good. And this is how I learned light painting, okay? Because like this is today. Okay? This is the studio as it is today with 176 cameras. But I started with way less than this in the super tiny studio. I had only access to 24 cameras. And the studio was super small, and I had my knowledge of using soft boxes, but using this, I was lighting up the whole rig, the whole room, and it was ugly. So just by trying things, the best answer, the best solution was to use light painting, like a very concentrated source of light around my subject. And so I kept pushing to get better at this. I wanted to make a project in 360, something artistic, because prior to this, I was programming that system. This was part of my life. My job was to connect multiple cameras together. Uh-huh. And we were doing just live events and having fun, but nothing artistic. And but at some point, I wanted to make, just to see, like to explore what could I do with this technology, and because I had access to this, I had the software. So after a few months, I came up to this 1 second light painting technique that was helping me to light up my subject without revealing the cameras around me, and still getting a very crisp image like for the subject. Mm-hmm. Of course, that requires the subject to stay still for 1 second, to not breathe for 1 second, but it is manageable. And that was kind of the starting point for me. And that's actually exactly 10 years ago, when I was doing this, hoping to get featured on big photography websites in order to get projects with this. And that worked. That was the plan, and that worked. Oh. I'm still rolling on that 10 years later.
That's great. You know what? You read my mind, because that was one of my next questions is, what, as artists, both of you, what is the driving force for creating the work? Is it, like you mentioned before, you like to travel, both of you like to travel to exciting places and explore and do photography there. Is the travel the main reason for creating the work? Is it you creating work for sale? Is it the education, you know, or teaching other photographers how to do it and making those resources available, both software or educational and hardware? What is the driving force that gets you guys, you know, excited about going to the next location?
It's always creative work, okay? We do what we want to do. This is just an urge to make something interesting, something that we would be proud of. But at the same time, I know that this is the way to get paid in the long run. This is how we get gigs with brands. And so just by delivering good quality work, we get seen by agencies or by brands, and then we can work on that kind of techniques. And one example from this year, we had one shot in 360 with some ghosting effect of a dancer, and somehow someone working for Apple saw that and they wanted to replicate that for the iPad Air ad that got released a few months ago. So it's crazy, you know, you do personal work. You just release things on Instagram, on TikTok, and then you can get seen. So never underestimate like the power of just doing things that you really want to do. So the, and that's been working for me for 10 years now. But I don't that's come great. From that world. I had no contact in agencies or in the creative world at all. I was just following the photography blogs like a lot of people are doing. But I saw that was kind of the way, if you get published on there, then it might open the door for something bigger.
Isn't that the smart way to do it? You know, a lot of that is brilliant, right? So you are aware that, okay, I need to make something to get noticed so that brands and, you know, other clients will see it and instantly understand that this is what I'm trying to do and then hire me, versus, you know, I'm going to go the opposite direction. I'm just going to keep learning and doing stuff, and maybe one day I'll create something that people like and then I'll be successful and well known and all that. So it sounds like you guys thought it out. You're like, okay, let's, what kind of beast are we trying to feed? Let's get the right food for that beast and create it, and then everyone's happy. So, you know,
I would add on to that, and that would be like the education part of it, because that's also a big motivation for us, and it has been since the beginning. Actually, we've been teaching and sharing about light painting since 2015, maybe probably before that. Wow. And having that in mind, when we were going somewhere to create, like for the sake of creation, for the love of creation, we also always had in mind, how can we communicate better? How can we make it simpler, more understandable, clearer, so that people can actually try it and make this technique their own? So, and by this dire desire of doing so, we improved a lot. We learned a lot, and it kind of pushed us to, I guess, get better at our craft, probably much faster than if we did not try to communicate and teach from the beginning. So I think that's an important part of the motivation, or what is motivating us in this journey.
Yeah, teaching or trying to explain a concept to someone, I think always sort of solidifies it in your brain, because you're forced to think through all the nuances from someone who doesn't understand how to do that. And where you may, they call it the curse of knowledge, right? Where you automatically know, of course everyone knows that light behaves like this, when they may not. So when you're explaining, you have to fill in all those holes, which then solidifies it in your brain.
You know, there's an integration, and also like you have to identify what is important to you to actually like share. So that's a process also.
Yeah. So the education, the getting noticed piece of it, and just personal creative soul fulfillment is why you guys are doing this. And then there's a hardware piece too. I know you guys have developed a number of tools over the years. Like you say, you've been doing this since 2015 at least, right? So you've refined tools, and the one that you were showing, Eric, just a few minutes ago. Can you talk about those a little bit? And the beginning obviously is just light, a flashlight, right? But you can take it all the way up to where, if you're really into this genre.
Yeah. And the plastic tube is really basic. So you were asking if you're going on a vacation, what do you bring with you? So the light tube is the best because it's a long source of light and going to make it easier for you to disappear behind that light. Okay, there are many other tools that are smaller. It's just harder to work outdoors with them. So the tube is the best and easiest way to get started with outdoors light painting the way we do it. So you could go to Home Depot or any hardware store and get one plastic tube and create something cool with it. But this is where it gets a bit more complicated. Depending on the time of the night you're going to shoot, you might want to have a different color inside of it. You might want to use holographic colors, okay? So then you have access to like tons of different colors or different materials in YouTube, different modifiers. So it's kind of like the studio photography world, but for light paintings. And when you start to study, because you keep thinking about different ways to improve your work or have a different shape, different texture on YouTube. So I do have my online store where I sell tubes, but I also teach you how to make tubes the way I use them. So what a bad business decision, right? But I prefer to do it this way. So you can follow my tutorials and make the tubes just assemble. Because if you get the plastic tube at the hardware store, don't have one with me. Yeah, anyway, it's going to be clear, okay, with no color inside of it. But then you can add parchment paper, like baking paper inside of it, so then it's going to diffuse, and you can add Roscoe gels inside of it. Depending on the color, you're going to get something different. So it's endless, okay? It's too much fun. I get super excited when I talk about this,
but
really, really fun.
Yeah, and you start overlaying things into there, right? So you start understanding and using the light tubes to do the light painting and creating different colors using the proper tool. But then there's also, okay, what if I want the Milky Way in the background? I want to do a long exposure and have that coming up behind Kim, and she's doing this fantastic pose, and we have this happening that, you know, you have all, yeah, like this shot, you know, you have all the things. And it's like you said, it's infinite. And then you overlay strobe in there if photographers want to start playing with that. So yeah, I'm already addicted and I'm just talking about it. Yeah.
Are we going to see a picture of you doing light painting in Hawaii?
Yes, you will. Absolutely. I commit to that, and I will share it with you. Well, let me commit. If it doesn't look like crap, I will share with you. So, which means I probably won't share it. Absolutely. It's a photography adventure that I'm going out there for. So yeah, I want to do that. And then I also wanted to talk about sort of forward facing, like what's next. I know like in the beginning of this interview, I mentioned you guys are really excited and heavy into, like for the past year or so, into the Web3 and NFT space. What drove you to that space? You're already on all the socials, right? You have your website and merch shop and all the things. Why add NFT and that whole world of uncertainty to the mix?
Yeah, we've been outside of the like photo galleries, like the physical galleries, like art galleries for forever. We don't know about that market. We don't know how to enter that. And NFTs was kind of the bridge, okay, because it's same kind of collectors. And so it was super great for us to learn about this kind of communities, but also the technology itself, because when you enter to the digital collectible world, you have to learn about crypto, and it's endless, and it's super motivating. And one of the biggest takeaway for us was to improve our kind of sub galleries. Okay, so every time we go out now, we're thinking about like where that picture we're going to create tonight is going to fit in the big picture of what we create, because it was easier with Instagram. We're just posting every day, new picture. Okay, was fun, but where is it going in the long term? Because we know that at some point, Instagram is going to be like MySpace, going to fade out. It is already fading out.
It is, yeah.
But digital collectibles, it's more long term, because it's not a specific platform owned by I don't know who, okay? So yeah. There's a way to think about your work in the long term when you enter that space, and Kim is going to say that in a much better way than I am. She's better than I am.
No, I think that's pretty much it, but I guess it allowed us to yeah, I mean, he wants to say hi.
For those listening, the cat just jumped on the table.
Is that Photon?
So it allows us to kind of have another perspective on our own like body of work, and to curate it in a way that we would want it to appear in a gallery or in a book or something that we didn't have in mind, or that was not even like within our, I'll say, consciousness, you know, like that was not part of the picture at all. So we are, the way now we create peace, we put much more thought, effort, intention, which was already there, but it's like, it's kind of giving another purpose as mm-hmm. to why this specific piece more than another. So it's really interesting how it impacts our process.
You're using NFTs and pricing them using, you know, the whole crypto and blockchain world. You're able to assign a specific value to a piece, and then when someone purchases that, it instantly legitimizes that piece as being worth that much, right? And how does that factor into your creation process? So in other words, like you mentioned Instagram, photographers on Instagram, TikTok or whatever, so they'll feed the beast. You're like, oh, I posted this thing and it got 100 likes, but when I post this thing, it gets 1,000. I have to do more of that over there. Do you work in that modality? And is in the NFT space, if you create and release a piece that, you know, a collector purchases for X dollars, and then you release another piece and it gets sold for XX dollars, do you create more of the bigger, higher selling piece? Or do your artistic sensibilities take over and you're like, I don't care what it sells for, I'm just gonna do it?
I guess it would be logical to think this way, but no, we don't really care. This is not our main source of revenues. We never cashed out any crypto by being in the digital collectibles world. It's more like the principle of the, it's like you mint your piece, it's there on the blockchain. I mean, the it's complex, this discussion, I have to be careful. It's not the image itself that is minted, but the contract to the image. But anyway, what I'm trying to say is that we're not at this moment, we're not thinking about the monetary value for what we're going to create, but we are thinking about the value for our collectors. Okay, so how is it going to evolve over time? We love to see some interaction on the collection itself. So getting some secondary sales, which is super important in that space. So that's one of the reasons why we are very active on Twitter, because this is where everything is currently about this specific thing.
Yeah.
Now, for the long run, it's adding us a big constraint. And this is not related to the price of the pieces themselves. It's just about these concepts. Like, we know, like, we're going to shoot with fire in some locations, some other ones is going to be in the sand dunes. And just we master that. Okay, we already have a lot of new images to continue to improve the quality of our work. But sometimes it's a bit more tricky, and this is why I brought up this specific picture over there. There's one collection of 9 images that we're doing with green something, so that's going to be complemented with probably Northern Lights. We never shot with Northern Lights, and we know it's going to be cold. You see what she's wearing on these images. It's going to be hard, but that's one of the motivation, one of the goals for the 2 next years and a half, because we have a goal in. Am I allowed to talk about that?
For sure, it will be the first time.
Sure.
Actually.
Okay.
So. Yeah, we're on the 10 years journey. Okay? So in 2025, in August, is going to be 10 years. Our 10 years anniversary doing this kind of work with light tubes outdoors.
Wow.
And by then, we need to reach a certain goal with the number of pictures and different styles, different things that we're going to create. So we're currently working on this. We already created many of these images. We just came back from a 2 month road trip creating just for this. But then we know that some of the pictures are going to be harder to make. She's going to be in the snow. It's going to be cold.
Yeah, and this, I think it comes from this idea of curating, like with intention, curating the collection and the pieces, which gives us new constraints, which we love for creation. When we have constraints, it means that we can push ourselves and explore where we probably would not have otherwise. So I think in that sense, it's something that is exciting for both of us.
That's awesome. Do you guys think in, like, when you're planning, like, first of all, what is the planning process for one of these longer trips? Are you conceptualizing what the shots are going to be? Are you in photo pills, checking out where the Milky Way is going to be and sketching out, this is what we kind of want to go for? And then the other part of that question is, are you, like, Eric, you mentioned the series of nine shots. Is that nine shots because you want to do a grid on Instagram or what? Can you talk through that a little bit?
Yeah, I guess Instagram probably led us to do the 3x3.
Yeah.
I didn't think about that, but of course it looks better on Instagram because we're taking in grids of nine. But then the nine is a bit complex because, like, the first image, Kim has to look like towards the center, and the center one has to be very centered.
There's a composition aspect within the nine pieces together when we look at them within, like, a grid of nine. So that's
some serious planning, though. I mean, that's planning, right? I mean, like, when you're out there, okay, this is shot number one, I think, or these next three shots could be possibly shot number one. So you have to be facing that way and, you know, composed in this way. Okay, now we're working on shot number four, which is going to be in the middle, right? So we have to do something more symmetrical. So how does that planning work? Are you guys just sitting around the kitchen table and just saying, like, thinking of locations on the map and then what the grid is going to be and the color palette and all that, or do you just get out there and knock it out?
Yeah, it depends because on some occasions, like, everything's going to change based on the clouds that we have that night.
Yeah.
So it can look totally different, and if we work with the moon, it's different also. But like a very specific case we had last winter, we were creating that grid of nine images with snow, and we had one missing. We already had one, but I thought it could be better. So we kept going out every time it was a bit snowy. And we know that Kim had to be on the left side of the frame. So my mind was set to that. We were walking in the woods, looking at the trees and trying to figure out the composition at minus 15 degrees Celsius. It was kind of hard, but so satisfying once we got it. Very happy. We got the last one in March, which was kind of late in the season, but yeah, we got it. And I feel like it's so addictive. Like, when we start thinking about these grids, I keep thinking about that all the time. And now, by having a plan for the next 2 years and a half, it's clear. The plan is clear. This is what we're doing.
Now the grid, I love that grid concept. So the grid, of course, compositionally, I understand the driving force, and it's a cohesive set, and it, you know, if you do it right, it'll look great on Instagram and all that. But are you also thinking in terms of presentation in, you know, say foundation, you know, as an NFT, or if someone buys it, I mean, like, if you're doing this is brilliant. Like, if someone buys it, you're playing into the human need to complete things, right? So if you buy one, you gotta have the other eight, right? And if you're gonna hang these on the wall, you gotta have the complete set. Well, you can have one, it'll look great, but the complete set would look stunning. Are you guys thinking that far down the road in terms of the marketing and the psychology of it all?
Yeah, since pretty much the beginning, we had different perks. If you get the central one, so number 5 out of 9 came with different value. And now we have a website that we built for collectors, so you can see your ranking based on the digital collectibles that you own. So if you have a central one, you get more points. So yeah, we're playing with this. It's a bit of fun, but no, the grid is not as beautiful on the different platforms because none are. I don't know. They're not showing the images the way we want, of course.
Yeah.
But we have a site where we have links to all to the way to purchase the these things. But also, there are no NFT platforms where you can show additional content for each piece. So this is why we built that website, nightreflection.com. For each of the images, we show the behind the scenes. So me holding the tube or just the location itself, the environment, what we did earlier that day, what we ate in the morning. and the story, because Kim is writing a short series about most of our shots. So, and there's nothing currently in the market to do all of that. Hopefully someday it's going to come, but for the moment, as there's nothing, there's like you cannot go to foundation and upload an image of the context that goes with the piece itself.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, kind of like if you buy this piece, it looks best presented this way. You're not able to do that. Are you, so I know you're selling your artwork as well. Do you have a lot of people that are printing or buying printed versions of the artwork? Is it mostly digital? Like what does that side of the business look like?
We've never been into that. Never tried to sell prints. We started actually after the NFTs to just propose that to potential buyers, but we don't put any efforts on that currently.
Yeah,
we do business with other things than prints.
Oh, interesting. What's next? What's next for you guys? Like, what's the future hold? What keeps you up at night right now? Like, there's the burning thing in the back of your brain. Like, we gotta go create this, you know, or we're gonna explode. What is that burning fire right now?
It's winter in Montreal. It's cold, so it's studio time for us. So
yeah.
We're going to work in 360. There are so many things to explore. We have a list of things we want to accomplish this winter in the studio. But of course, we're going to travel a bit. So we're going south in 2 weeks. And next year, we're going to Photopills. You mentioned Photopills. I wanted to plug them.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so we're doing the Photopills camp every year. This is where we teach our stuff, light painting outdoors at the beach, on rocks. So it's a good place to learn all of that. So Photopills is the app that we're using to plan our nights, to figure out where it's going to be, the Milky Way, at what time, at what location, same thing with the moon. And they also have a camp for photographers every year. And
oh, wow.
Happy mm-hmm. to be part of that.
Wait, Photopills, they have a Photopills as a camp? I didn't know that. Oh. Mm-hmm. Wow. Okay. I had no idea. Yeah, that's great. That makes sense, obviously. I mean, you know, if you want to really get good at knowing your location and pre-predicting what the scene's going to look like and where the Milky Way is going to be, where the moon or the sun, that's the app for it. And I would imagine you guys rely on that heavily. So what's the other one? There's Photopills and then there's...
There are no other ones.
No. Cut it right there. No more. Just Photopills.
Oh, I don't nice. Know. You don't know.
Okay, I won't mention the other one. That's good.
Besides that, like we will be creating a lot in studio, but we've been traveling for 2 months this fall, and we have a lot of data to process.
Yeah,
video,
my eyes are bleeding.
Pictures. So we created a lot of stuff, both in light painting and in dance photography. So we'll be also working on those pieces.
Love it. You guys are busy in a really good way. So let's end on just sort of the gear piece. I forgot to ask you about, we talked about the lighting gear and all that. Of course, tripod is integral to all this. But what camera, well, we talked about lenses as well, but what camera bodies do you guys gravitate to? And then also on the post-processing side, where does the you know, I'm sure you're not doing that much post-processing, but where does that happen? Is it Lightroom or Capture One or Photoshop? How does all that work? Camera body and post-processing.
Okay, so the camera, I heard on a recent podcast of yours that doesn't matter if you're using an older camera.
And, true.
Yes and no, it depends. And on my side, I'm pushing the settings to the very limit because it's low light photography and it's hard to get the details that you want. It's and I see a drastic difference at every upgrade. I'm shooting with Canon. I started with the 6D, I think, Lightmaking. I started way before that when I was doing other kind of photography, but Lightmaking, I think I started with the 6D, so when I upgraded to the 5D2, 5D3, and then 5D4, major upgrade, the R was a tiny bit better, but then the R5. It's so good, and I've been shooting with this for since its launch, so I have three of those now. This is what I travel with. And a bunch of lenses, 14, 24, 35, always wide aperture, because this is how we can get stars at night. Okay, so mm-hmm. I'm going to shoot at f1.4 just to get more lights, more stars out of focus behind Kim. A lot of our pictures are actually made with this this trick. So it's very low light on the flashlight itself, very dim light, and then 8 seconds to get the background in a single exposure, which is bringing us to the post-processing. I come from the Photoshop world, so I like to edit my pictures, but what I like on top of all of that is when my video, the behind the scenes, matches with the picture itself. So over the years, I became better at getting everything in a single shot just to match with what I'm teaching, because I would feel bad to add a Milky Way or add something that was not there, film the process, and then whoops, here's something else that was not there. So it's mostly about keeping this authentic experience with what we created on one night. So video and photo has to match, but sometimes things can be a bit more complicated, especially with the wind, with the snow. So let's say a very typical case, we do location scouting during the day after a big snowfall and everything looks perfect, and we go back in the same night, and then snow has fallen from the branches, so the foreground is not as clean. So my background in Photoshop is helping me to clean out of that.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, I was going to ask about that. The new masking tools in Photoshop and Lightroom and Lightroom Mobile and other tools like Skylooms, you know, the Luminar and all these tools that do sky replacements and this advanced masking and, you know, kind of shortening the path of getting to a great image in some ways. Contrasting those superpowers that those apps have now with your process of getting it all right in camera, do those tools just like, okay, I don't care about that. I'm never ever going to do a sky replacement. I'm just going to get it, you know, okay. And that's valid, right? Because it's part of your process. It's part of the joy for you is the getting it right in a single frame versus creating raw materials that will then be assembled later. But through that lens, do you just avoid those tools completely, or if you need them, you'll use them? What do you think?
I don't need them. I don't use them. I'm okay with the fact that it exists. I think there's the same kind of conversation with AI yeah. art, and it's tools. It's good technology, and I don't do sky replacement, but I use AI in my work. Not to create stuff, but I'm creating in between frames in my 360. So there is a lot of value in this technology for me. But to answer the specific question about like the sky replacement, it's not something I'm interested in too. But I know that it can be a great tool if you're doing real estate. You take a picture of a house, the sky was flat. It's easy. You get it. You get your new sky. So it's a super great tool.
Yeah, I think it depends. Like I said, it depends on what the thing that you're trying to do is, right? So if, like you mentioned, real estate. So if it's real estate, you just want to get the shot of the house, you want to make it look great, the client is happy, on to the next one. But if the process is part of the product, right? If the process is, you know, we enjoy going to amazing places and pushing our photographic skills to the point where we could make a nearly perfect image in a single frame, and that's where we find joy, then that's, you know, absolutely. Then the question, part of the question is, at the end of the day, if a relatively inexperienced photographer goes out, tries some stuff, throws a Milky Way back there, and you create something amazing, and not to say that they're similar, but to a layperson, they're like, oh, okay, I don't know what's different. Do you care about that? If like, is it cheating to you that a photographer would go in there and say, okay, I did this mediocre shot and made it amazing with the tools that are available versus understanding light and exposure and composition and hiking over sharp rocks to get to the great location and doing all the things, Kim holding her pose, not having any caffeine that morning, you know, all the things. How does that make you feel? Does it feel like other photographers are cheating, or do you even care about that?
I don't really care about that. I don't think about that, actually. So
good. Yeah.
Asking me the question that I don't know, but I know no bad thing. The tools are there. So I just wish people can do whatever they want.
Yeah.
What I don't like is when people are bashing others because of the technique they're using.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
But the tools are there. Just do whatever makes you happy.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. If people want to use those tools as a way to like express their creativity, I don't see, there are no problem with that. I think if they are not interested in learning how to master the technique, for me, these are two possibilities. For us, it's really, we like to say that light painting is a lifestyle, so it kind of, it's all part of that same like philosophy, and enjoying the fact that the process is with kind of, I'll say, great simplicity. When we go out, we hike for a long time with minimal gear that we need, only the two of us, to enjoy also like the location, the nature, the silence. So that's, for us, that's all part of the process, but we are conscious that it's not for everyone, and it's not what everyone would enjoy about creating light painting. So
yeah. And on any of these adventures, have you guys had any sticky situations? Like you're working on a shot and, you know, a bear or something shows up or something crazy like that? Or has it been, you know, what's the stickiest situation that you guys have found yourself in on one of these adventures?
Well, she doesn't want me to talk about the crocodiles anymore, so we're not doing that.
No crocodiles.
You can imagine something with some crocodiles, potential crocodiles. Though we didn't encounter any, but
yeah.
Oh, there was even the potential of them.
Yeah. No, and actually we love very harsh conditions, like strong wind. Oh, we avoid bears. Okay, we don't work in Western Canada because of that. Yeah. There might be other things. Like we work in deserts, and I guess there are some dangers over there.
Yeah, Scorpios.
I think we're lucky. I don't know, but we're looking for harsh conditions, like wind, snow, something that looks dramatic. I'm not sure why, but I enjoy. I feel alive when it's hard. But other than that, no.
I guess that, and maybe that's more on my side, but I like when we take kind of calculated risk. So I try to make to prepare things and to be prepared just in case something happens, because we never know, right?
Yeah. Rooftoping, it's another thing that came to my mind. We stopped doing that.
Yeah.
I think we did it twice. And
what is it? Rooftoping?
Rooftoping, yeah. I'm not scared, and that's the problem.
Fear is there for a reason, Eric.
Yeah, exactly.
And it's after the shot that I realized, oh, that that was a bit dangerous. Like I was like on the edge, nothing in. So yeah, don't do that anymore just because I know when it's daylight, I'm super scared. I cannot climb a ladder, but when it's dark, suddenly it's like there's no worries, nothing's going to happen, but it's not true. So
also I feel like as we're teaching a lot, we also feel like there's a responsibility that comes with it. So we would not put ourselves in dangerous situations to kind of inspire someone else to do so. So yeah. I think that's an important point for us. And we don't do like risky stuff for nature, for instance, like we don't use paint, like, or anything that is a chemical in the water. We don't use fire near anything that could catch up on fire. So
no like steel wool.
Never. No steel.
Okay.
Okay. Well, we use sparklers, but in safe areas.
Yeah, that's so great. I mean, you guys are so inspiring. There's so much to try. And one of the takeaways that I am getting from this discussion is like people will look at your work and think it's complex. Well, yeah, the bullet time stuff, sure, that's complex and expensive, but the basic technique of light painting it's simple. The hard part, I think, is what we kind of, shone a light on, and that's the planning part of it, and the choreography, and the subject, and all the things that go around the actual technique of capturing the image, which is the fun part, I think, and practicing it over years and getting better and better at it that's the key, right? Versus, I got to go. If I want to do this kind of work, I got to go buy $10,000 worth of gear, and then I could be like, Eric and Kim. No, you can go to Home Depot, right?
That's a super good point. And one of the proof we had, because we're doing it by ourselves, because we like it, but is it really simple? Like, maybe not. But the proof that we had over the years is that a lot of people from our community, they don't come from photography. They saw our work and they picked up a camera to do light painting. Mm. It's cool.
Mm. Yeah, that's so good. That is so good. So if we'll end it right there. If folks want to follow you guys or, learn how to do this technique or start experimenting with it, you mentioned there's a checklist you have. Like where should folks start to get going on their light painting journey?
On tubestories.tv. That's the starting point.
Tubestories.tv. That's it. That's the starting point for, the thing that's going to consume your time for all of 2023, right?
Yeah.
Go there with caution.
Videos about us being... doing stupid things in the nature, I don't know. But yeah, and we love to just show our story, how we created the shot, where we've been traveling, and all of the different food that we tasted over the years.
Yeah, that's so cool. That's so cool. Keep doing what you guys are doing. This is amazing. And you're welcome to come on the show anytime you want and discuss this stuff. This is, the whole idea of light, since, I was in the military as a combat photojournalist for 8 years. And when I first started, the thing that seduced me, I guess, was light, like the nerdy part of it, understanding the speed of light and how light reacts and how we really still don't understand exactly why light does a lot of the things that it does, like gravity. We kind of know what it's going to do, but we don't know why, right? So there's a lot of mystery and romanticism to light. And I love it when photographers, talented photographers in teams like you guys are, take that to the next level and just sort of show this is time over a, this is light over a period of time. And this is the stuff that you can do with this stuff that's available to all of us. That's just amazing. So congratulations on doing what you do. Please do more of it. I'll be heading over to, give me the URL again, Eric.
Tubestories.tv.
TubeStories.tv, which will be on the screen down here for folks to check out. It'll be in the show notes and in the description of the YouTube video. So head over there, check out the work, and start learning. You're on social media, obviously. Do you one of the things that we didn't talk about, maybe we'll talk about in the next interview, is just sort of the community aspect of the NFT space and how that world is, it's really interesting from the standpoint of collectors being able to be connected to the artists themselves and have that dialogue back and forth versus, hey, I made this thing, go get it. Are you finding that that two-way communication is adding to your creativity? Or, you know, what do you think? You know, the versus, say, the a thread on an Instagram post, participating in, you know, Discord discussions and Twitter threads and all that stuff, does that add to your creativity fuel, or is it just kind of a rounding error on the outside?
Not on the creative part, but more about learning different different kind of community with the collector.
Yes, it's a lot about relationship and understanding. It's very interesting from also our perspective, like our artist's perspective, to understand what makes somebody else actually want to collect art. Like, because some people collect a lot of art and we create art. So it's kind of really interesting to share those perspective about like around the same subject that is like art. So
art. So Kim, I gotta tell you, I made a note while you were talking, and the title of this episode is going to be Light Painting as a Lifestyle. So that's it.
Well, that's it. Perfect. I think that if you go on, can you go on to stories.tv? The headline is Light Painting is a Lifestyle.
Oh, perfect. There you go. There you go. Because so I'm not brilliant.
Well, you are.
Yes. You felt it. You felt that what was about. And that came from a debate that happened a while ago between light painters. And the question was, is light painting a technique or an art form? And my answer was, it's a lifestyle.
Interesting. Yeah. And I guess you have to get into it and actually make some exposures to start understanding that bit of it. Otherwise, you're just reading books, right? And looking at videos and all that, which you can do all day long, especially you've got hundreds up there, right? But when you get out there, put your camera on a tripod, make mistakes, have successes, then you start building the synapses and connections in your brain that, oh, when I do that, this happens. I want more of that and less of that, right? So,
yeah. What I find interesting is a lot of people, when they try the technique, a lot of comments we get is how fun it is to create and explore. And I think that's a key to learning anything. If you get like in a playful mode, in a curious mode, it means that you are more receptive to making errors and trying things. Yeah. Because you're not judging. So I think that's an interesting aspect of the technique. A lot of people just, they have fun while they learn, so.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Like, I approach a lot of life like that. Like, I give myself permission to fail because I'm approaching things as an experiment anyway, versus if I do this thing and it doesn't turn out right, I'm a failure, right? If you approach it as, hey, I'm just experimenting, and the scientific method says I have to try a bunch of different ways in order to find the right one. If you approach it that way, then it's you take the pressure off of failure, you know, because you're learning. In the end, you're learning something anyway. So very good. Thank you both for coming on. You guys are amazing. It's a pleasure, inspiring talking to you. You know, tubestories.tv is my next stop on this. Everyone who's watching this, go to tubestories.tv, check it out. And I got to put you on the spot, both of you. You have to agree to come on again and, you know, discuss more things. I want to dive in deeper on a number of topics and a little bit more on technique. I want to dive into your thoughts on the NFT and crypto space and blockchain, all that stuff. So maybe we'll do that in another interview, but this one is fantastic. Thank you both for coming on. I appreciate it.
And the future of Flickr also, right?
And the future of Flickr. Yes. I forget what side it's on. Right there. Yeah.
Yes. Whatever you want. That's going to be a pleasure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. We will talk offline about Flickr. I want to have some conversations and get your thoughts on things over on that side of the house. So thank you so much, guys, for coming on. This is fantastic. And we'll talk soon. Be safe out there.
You too. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
This is Twit.